So today we finally, officially, are going to begin covering the SN2 and SN1 reactions. So we're going to get most of the way through SN2 today, then we'll do SN1 on Thursday. We'll run out a little bit of time for today, so we're going to have to continue a little bit SN2 next time. But I wanted to tackle two different things. One, there are these six different aspects of a chemical reaction that I presented. The utility, the reagents, the condition, the mechanism, stereochemistry, regiochemistry. I want to review all of those for the SN2 reaction so that you can start to make your flashcard for that. And then I want to talk about four factors that can have an effect on an SN2 reaction. One of those we've already discussed before, which is the structure of the target molecule itself, or what I'm going to refer to as the substrate. So whether that substrate's primary, secondary, or tertiary is going to affect the rate of the reaction. But there are three other factors that we probably didn't discuss much at the time at all, as I was focusing just on mechanism at that point. But one of them is, what kind of nucleophile are you using? There are good nucleophiles and poor nucleophiles for the SN2 reaction, so we need to talk about that classification. Then there's what's called the leaving group itself, the thing that gets kicked off in a reaction. So we need to talk about what makes a good leaving group. And then there's solvent effects. So let's start with those six aspects of the reaction. And to do that, let me just redraw a mechanism for the SN2 reaction. Going to use a primary alkyl halide, but one labeled with deuterium so that I can have a stereocenter. As I've done with example reactions before, I'll go ahead and use hydroxide as the incoming nucleophile. And the product of the reaction, in this case, is going to be an alcohol. So as far as the synthetic utility, it's to convert, usually, but not exclusively, an alkyl halide to one of a small number of functional groups that, for right now, we're going to say includes alcohols, ethers, and thiols. Again, as we get more into this reaction, we'll start broadening our target functional groups, but this will be good for now. Yes? I mean, what's the purpose of the reaction? What's the use of the reaction? So last time we saw free radical halogenation, and its purpose was to take an alkane and make an alkyl halide. So this is to take an alkyl halide and then make, as I've shown in this example, an alcohol or very closely related mechanism, make an ether, or just substitute sulfur instead, and you've got a thiol. So that brings us to the types of reagents that are used. Which for an SN2 reaction, it's usually going to be something basic, and it does have to be a nucleophile. And we're going to talk about the difference between nucleophilicity and basicity in class today. So examples of such reagents are sodium hydroxide, as I've already shown. You could take deprotonated alcohols, known as alkoxides, structurally very similar to hydroxide, undergo the same types of reactions. But we will see other molecules like cyanide being able to undergo this type of reaction as well. What are the conditions? Well, this is something we'll address when we get to solvent effects. But I'll go ahead and state it here that we need to use, ideally, what is known as a polar aprotic solvent. And just to give you a very brief definition for the moment, protic means something that has relatively easily dissociatable protons. And if you have hydrogens that are easily dissociatable, and then you have basic nucleophiles that you're trying to have react, well, if you have, let's say in an extreme case, an acid-base reaction between the solvent and the nucleophile, well, then of course you're not going to have your nucleophile work very well. So we want something that's aprotic, does not interact with the nucleophile, and so the nucleophile more easily can attack its target substrate. Now the fourth item is mechanism, which I have up above. As far as classifying the mechanism, we would say it's anionic and it's concerted, meaning that the two steps shown, nucleophile coming in attack and the bond breaking, both occur at the same time. And it is the fact that you have almost always for the SN2 reaction a negatively charged species that does the attacking. So anionic type of mechanism. What is the stereochemical consequence of this reaction? Well, it is inversion of configuration, and we'll talk about why momentarily. And then finally, as far as regiochemistry, well, it is specific. In this reaction, it is only the site where the leaving group is located where you're going to have substitution occurring. So the regiochemistry is specific at the site of the leaving group. Now let me rewrite the reaction so I can identify some of the different components, because I keep using these terms, nucleophile, leaving group, but let's make sure that we know which one is which. So first, the alkyl halide, or more generally the molecule that's going to be attacked, I refer to that as the substrate. And then nucleophile. What is a nucleophile? Something that wants a positive charge. So the hydroxide in this case, because it's negatively charged, is going to be the nucleophile. And then the leaving group. That is the portion of the molecule that's going to come off during substitution. And again, in just a moment, we're going to discuss each of these different things. The nucleophile, what its effect on the reaction is, the leaving group and what its effect is, and then first one we'll tackle, because it's the easiest, is the substrate. But before we move into that, I just want to review this idea that the mechanism occurs with inversion of configuration. So I've drawn the product again here. And we see the sigma bond that is there between the carbon and the bromine. Think a few weeks back when we were doing bonding and antibonding. And you might remember that a sigma bond is one that lies in between the two nuclei. And it's because that sigma bond lies between the two nuclei that you have electrons between positive charges, which is a favorable interaction. So that's why the bond wants to form. The antibond, on the other hand, has orbitals or portions of the orbital on the either side of the nucleus, on the outside of that bond. So let me just put that up to the side here as a reminder. So sigma bond, to simplify, looks something like this. Electrons distributed between nuclei. A sigma star bond, if I worried about shading, would look like this. Again, electrons towards the outside with a node in between. Well, let's take that picture of the antibond and superimpose it on top of the carbon-bromine bond. And for simplicity, let me drop the distinction between the positive and negative sign of the wave function. Let's just put the orbital itself. So again, that's the sigma star carbon bromine bond. Of course, it's empty to start with, because if it were full, you wouldn't even have the carbon bromine bond. But this is where the electrons of the nucleophile end up. Now you could look at that and say, well, there's two different ends. Couldn't the nucleophile in theory attack either of these lobes? And in theory, yes, but why does the nucleophile want to attack the substrate in the first place? What's the driving force of this reaction? Why is it that alkyl halides are much more reactive than just plain old alkanes? Yes? That's right. So in plain old alkanes, there's hardly any polarity differences across the molecule at all. So that's why, even though sometimes it might be uncontrolled, free radical halidation can be a good reaction, because at least you get a product that's reactive. So because of that polarity difference, because of the fact that there's a delta positive at that position where the carbon is, that's why the nucleophile is going to be attracted to that side of the molecule, not where the bromine is. Yes? Because we, I haven't gotten to solvents yet, so I didn't want to sidetrack us yet.
So the second question is, I don't know if I'm asking you to draw a small diagram, but you're talking about the empty p orbitals in that particular alkyl.
No, not the p orbital. No, that's why I drew this picture up here. We got the sigma bond and then the sigma star bond. Okay. So then I said, imagine that we took that picture of the sigma star and just put it right down on top of that picture of the molecule. So the sigma bond would be here between the carbon and the bromine, and the sigma star is on either side of each of those two atoms.
Is that how it's usually oriented in molecule?
Yes, wherever the bond is, then the antibond is pointed collinear, but just on the opposite side. And so then that's what I was talking about, the attack of the nucleophile. The nucleophile, it's going to donate its electrons into this antibonding orbital, that once it does, it causes the carbon-bromine bond to break. And then we were viewing polarity to say that it's going to be the carbon that's more likely the end that's going to get attacked, because it's more positive and the nucleophile's negative. So it makes more sense for it to go to that end. But that end is pointed directly behind from where the bromine is located. So once the nucleophile attacks, you make a new bond at that position, you've kicked the bromine off, but therefore you have inverted the stereochemistry of that position. So you can imagine that hydroxide comes from behind to fill that antibonding orbital. So in SN2 reactions, the nucleophile attacks by adding into the sigma star bond to the leaving group. Since electrons are added into the antibonding orbital, the bond of the leaving group is going to break. Since that bond is broken, and since the electrons have already attacked that carbon, a new bond is able to form, but in the completely opposite direction of where the leaving group had been. And that is inversion of configuration. Now, I'd like to do something we have not yet done with mechanisms. And let me pull, I know you need to still write this down, but let me just pull this down for a moment. If you look back up the mechanism, you see that we have two arrows involved in the same step and we show the product. This is the way that mechanisms are normally shown. But every once in a while, if we want to discuss a reaction, we might want to know what is the structure of the transition state. Now, I'm making a big deal of this because anytime on a quiz or an exam where I ask you about mechanism, I'm not going to want you to show transition states because that really can slow you down, particularly if we haven't gone, because we won't go over every single transition state for every single reaction because it's not always important. But I want to do it just in this one case because it's another way of discussing this inversion of configuration. So first, a reminder to ourselves, what would the reaction coordinate diagram for this reaction look like? And let's say that if we're going to have a successful SN2 reaction, it's going to be exothermic. So how many humps would we have in the reaction coordinate diagram? One. Why only one? Because there's only one step to the reaction. Remember that every step has its own transition state. So we could draw a reaction coordinate diagram that looks like this. Reactants on the left, products on the right, and then we'll have the transition state. The transition state is closer in energy to the reactants than the products. And remember that last lecture we had gotten this concept of the Hammond postulate. Which, what does the Hammond postulate say? To the product, right. So in other words, the structure of the transition state more closely matches whatever is closest to it in energy. In this case, the reactant is closer to an energy, so the transition state's gonna look a little bit more like the reactant. Let's see if we can try to draw the structure of the transition state. And this might be a bit confusing, and I admit this up front, I'm just not the best drawer in the world, so I'll do as good a job as I can. Let's imagine that we have a molecule oriented so that we have hydrogen and bromine as I've drawn here in the plane of the paper. If I do this, then that means one group's going to have to point towards us, one group is going to have to point back away from us. And let's say, just for what I'm about to show you, that we imagine those two groups are pointed directly in front and directly in back. Now, I'm going to have to write this, though, draw it at a little bit of an angle or we won't be able to see the two groups. So let's say I take the alkyl group, put it in front, and the deuterium, and have it in back. From the discussion we just had, we know that hydroxide is going to come from exactly behind where the bromine is located. So if bromine's pointed out to the right, then the hydroxide's going to come in from the left, and it's going to push the bromine out. Now here's the part where normally you're not going to have to write. But there will be a couple of reactions where we do need to discuss transition state. So that's part of the reason to do it here. Only a one-step reaction, relatively easy to figure out. So bromine bond is breaking, but hasn't broken yet at the point where it's at the transition state because the transition state more closely resembles the structure of the reactant. The nucleophile's coming in to attack, but it hasn't formed the bond yet because, again, we're still looking more like the reactants. At one moment, though, you're effectively going to have a planar structure where the hydrogen is getting pushed over to the other side of the molecule as the bromine is being kicked out. So in that case, you can think of the hydroxide being directly left, trying to make a bond, and the bromine being kicked out to the right. So I'm going to write these arrows in, but please realize the arrows I'm about to write are not mechanism arrows. It's just I can't animate paper. So I want to show the hydroxides coming in as the bromine's coming off. Think of it kind of like an inverting umbrella. You're pushing the hydrogen from one side to the other. The handle, you could say, had been where bromine is, but we're going to invert it. So what we get out the other side is now hydroxide is connected instead, but you have pushed that hydrogen all the way to the other side of the molecule. If we're drawing all of this with the alkyl group and the deuterium still in the same position. So again, this is inversion, because what left is in the opposite direction of what came in. So we've covered a fair bit this morning. Let me pause and ask, are there other questions about those six conditions? Although recognize we still need to come back and talk about some of them. Or more importantly, are there questions about this inversion of configuration? Yes.
So is the hydrogen and the bromine that's technically switching places after the pushing of the hydrogen to the left is complete?
If you're imagining that you can hold the deuterium and the alkyl group still, then yes. We could draw this from another perspective where we show the alkyl group being displaced. One way or another, if you imagine a tetrahedron, you've got the three groups of that tetrahedron that all of them really are going to be inverting, kind of like an umbrella.
But I thought the inversion was whenever I see like a solid wedge, the nucleophile that attacks it, when it's inverted, it gets the gash.
That's the easy way to write it on paper. But if we try to draw it geometrically, again, if you think of the structure of a tetrahedron, you could lay a tetrahedron down and set it down on the table. One group will be pointed up while the other three are pointed the opposite way. Well, if you're inverting stereochemistry, that means all three of those groups are going to be pointed the opposite way once this is done. So I've shown it on paper as only one switching places. What we really need is an animation to show all three of them moving. So I'm just doing as good a job as I can to represent it in little stationary bits. But it's really all three groups that move. Other questions? All right, so let's get to these factors of the substrate. And, well, today we'll only have time to talk about substrate, nucleophile, and leaving group. And then we'll talk about solvent effects on Thursday. So going to the substrate first. That we've already covered. There's a bio test today, isn't there? Or something, isn't it? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18. I hope everybody else has shown up to lab. So our first factor we're going to talk about is substrate, and let's compare methyl bromide versus ethyl bromide versus isobutyl bromide versus tert-butyl bromide. If we looked at the relative rates of reaction, which we had a relative rate discussion last lecture when we were talking about the formation of primary versus secondary versus tertiary radicals. In that case, there was a connection between the energy difference and the rate that resulted. So the faster reactions happen for the more energetically favorable reactions. So if we assign the secondary alkyl halide a relative rate of 1, then the tertiary is for all effective purposes 0. It just doesn't want to react. Versus about 40, a round number for a primary position, a very open primary position, versus about 1,200 for a methyl group itself. So what was the reason for this big difference in reactivity that we had discussed in that big overview lecture? Yes? And what's the two-word? That's right. The two-word answer for that is steric hindrance. That because the attack of the nucleophile depends on being able to get to that position behind the leaving group, if it can't get there easily, there won't be a reaction. And by the time you get to a tertiary alkyl halide, that's enough of this steric hindrance that it effectively makes the reaction impossible. So since the SN2 reaction depends on the nucleophile directly attacking the carbon, directly attacking the carbon bearing the leaving group, steric hindrance around that position will slow the rate of reaction or prevent it. Now, in fact, it isn't quite as simple as just whether it's primary, secondary, or tertiary, because you can have a primary reaction site that still won't be reactive. And the classic example of that is neopentyl bromide. If you put sodium hydroxide, try to react it with neopentyl bromide, effectively, there's no substitution. Or if there is, it's incredibly slow. And why should that be? Well, because even though the primary position itself might not be too hindered, you've got all the stuff next door that's branched enough, taking up enough room, that it can prevent substitution. So just watch out for trick cases like this as you're reading through the text. Neopentyl, that's a common gotcha. Now let's see. There's one other example I want to show for now, because we still do have that experiment you did a few weeks back with the alkyl halides. But I have delayed the lab report for that until we had the chance to talk about some of those molecules here in lecture. Well, the time's finally arrived. So if we look back at that group of 10, which we'll do in lab one day soon so that we can wrap up that experiment. You had some primary alkyl halides, tertiary alkyl halides, secondary alkyl halides. You should have seen a positive reaction for the primaries and secondaries, but not the tertiaries. There's also one other molecule that you should not have seen a reaction for. Which is bromobenzene. Now, benzene is the name of the molecule itself, but benzene, if it becomes a substituent, has a different name for the substituent. Does anybody happen to know that name? Phenyl group, that's right. So P-H-E-N-Y-L. So why do you imagine that phenyl halides do not undergo SN2 reactions?
Mm-hmm.
Benzene does have unusual reactivity because it's what is known as aromatic, but that isn't influencing this particular reaction. Think about what the approach of the nucleophile would be. He would have to come through the molecule. The antibonding orbital would be pointing right in the middle of benzene here. So you'd have to come through the benzene molecule attack, which it can't do. So NU is a general symbol sometimes used for nucleophile, and what I'm showing is just not possible. It's pointed inward, right in the middle of the molecule.
And
it can't get in the middle, and it can't, it's not like a car, it can't just suddenly switch directions either as it comes in. So phenyl halides do not undergo SN2 because of too much steric hindrance, you could say. Now, there are some other molecules from that group we need to talk about, but I'm going to tackle them when we talk about SN1 reactions on Thursday. So next I want to talk about nucleophiles. And to get into that, let's talk about the difference between something being nucleophilic and something being basic. So nucleophilicity, we discussed that earlier, and we've determined that that's how strongly does a compound seek positive charge. And one of the most common ways that nucleophiles are classified is by charge. Because if, let's say, we're just comparing hydroxide versus water, they're just acid conjugates of each other. Which one would be the much better nucleophile in an SN2 reaction? Why hydroxide? Because it has a negative charge. If you were having a nucleophilic reaction, it's seeking out positive charge. What more actively seeks out positive charge? Neutral water or negatively charged hydroxide? Well, it's going to be negatively charged hydroxide, but it's not automatically because hydroxide's basic. But let me write this much down before we get to that question. So hydroxide is much more nucleophilic because it has a negative charge on it. Before we talk about the distinction between nucleophilicity and basicity, we better make sure that we have a definition for basicity. Which I'll go ahead and describe it this way for this argument. It's the ability to pull off a hydrogen from a molecule. Now, there are, of course, the Lewis acid-based definitions that have nothing to do with hydrogens. But because of the side reaction that we're going to discuss, and I'll show you an example in a moment, but after we finish SN2 and SN1, there's also E2 and E1, the elimination reactions, that occur when a base pulls a hydrogen off. Because that's the mechanism, that's why I want to define it this way. How able is a compound to remove H+? And just to talk about an example, basic nucleophile, we could generalize this structure, the OR minus group, R being just a plain alkyl group. So this is a deprotonated alcohol. The general term for these molecules is alkoxide, which is a contraction of alkyl oxide. And we'll talk about naming of alkoxides next lecture, because we're going to run out of time today. But, so nucleophilic means likes to attack positive charge. Basic means it likes to pull off an H+. What's an example of these being different? Well, let's look at the case of OH- versus SH-. And to compare the two, let me put up that for water, the pKa is 15.74. For hydrogen sulfide, it's right at 7. And do not confuse that with it being neutral. pKa of 7 is just an equilibrium constant. Has nothing directly to do with pH being 7. But if I give you these two pieces of information, which of the two molecules is more basic? Hydroxide or SH minus? Hydroxide, because the lower the pKa, or sorry, the higher the pKa, the lower the Ka, the less strong of an acid it is. Water being the weaker acid, if you force it to deprotonate, therefore becomes the stronger conjugate base. So hydroxide is the stronger base. But if you threw a primary alkyl halide at a solution that had both hydroxide and SH minus in it, by far the major product is going to be the one with sulfur in it. Even though hydroxide is more basic, it doesn't matter because that sulfur is actually the stronger nucleophile. Now, if you've read the section, you already know why it is that sulfur is a better nucleophile. Has anybody had a chance to read the section yet, though? Well, what's the difference between oxygen and sulfur? They're different sizes, aren't they? Sulfur is below oxygen on the periodic table. Sulfur is therefore a squishier ion, you could say, than oxygen. Not a very technical term. The technical term would be polarizable. Polar means to have plus and minus. Polarizable means it's able to become plus and minus. Able for some of that electron density to be moved around a bit. Oxygen's a tighter, smaller ion, holds its electrons more tightly, therefore doesn't let them start interacting with another orbital as easily in a chemical reaction. Sulfur being the bigger, squishier ion, it may not have as concentrated a negative charge, but therefore that electron density can begin the process of forming a bond more easily because that electron density can be more easily displaced. Sulfur is more polarizable. So because of polarizability, when this attack of the nucleophile begins, sulfur with its bigger, squishier ion begins the process of donating electrons into the antibonding orbital much more easily. So much more easily that that's why it's a much better nucleophile than oxygen is. Yes?
I was going to say fluorine is right next to oxygen, but on the other side of it.
And fluorine is... Then you would say fluorine is a poor nucleophile with than hydroxide, which I believe it is. It's less basic than hydroxide. And of course, we're not making a fair comparison because it's fluoride versus oxide itself we shouldn't be comparing. But even hydroxide, that's really basic, but still more able to attack and give that electron density than the less basic and even more tightly packed fluorine. So, back to the sulfur example. Ah, yes. So let's define polarizability. Polarizability means able to become polarized. Which in this case means, you could describe it as the following. Larger ions are squishier. And yes, I'd accept that as an answer on an exam. Larger ions are squishier, meaning that electron density can be more easily displaced. So, since sulfur is more polarizable than oxygen, the process of forming a bond occurs more easily. Since more easily effectively has an energetic connotation to it, that there's this smaller barrier to that process beginning, that also is going to mean a faster rate. So since sulfur is more polarizable than oxygen, the process of forming a bond occurs more easily and therefore more quickly. For sulfur versus oxygen. That means sulfur is more nucleophilic. Than oxygen, if we're comparing similar molecules. Now I mentioned there's a side reaction that could occur. And this is why we need to worry about something being nucleophilic versus something being basic. So the side reaction is the following. Let's say that you had a tertiary alkyl halide. And let's say that we did throw a basic nucleophile like hydroxide at it. Or let's take it to one more extreme. Let's say that the nucleophile itself has a lot of steric hindrance around it. So even if the alkyl halide might be able to be attacked, now I've got a nucleophile that itself would have difficulty getting in to attack that position. But notice I've written a hydrogen out here. The hydrogen is much further away from all of the steric hindered site that we have around the bromine. So what if this little itty bitty hydrogen could be pulled off by the nucleophile? Well, then that pair of electrons that had been in there could collapse and it be the thing that kicks off the leaving group. That's exactly what can happen, and this is therefore called an elimination reaction. Specifically, this is the E2 reaction, because all two molecules are involved at the same time in the one reaction step. But let's not talk about elimination yet, because we have a whole lecture on it. So coming back to nucleophiles versus electrophiles, or sorry, versus bases. It most certainly can, and what we'll get into after we've formally covered elimination is how do you know which one's more likely. So SN2 reactions require strong nucleophiles. You need something to force that leaving group off. These nucleophiles are often, but not always, basic. But here's the important point for the future. Extremely basic nucleophiles especially sterically hindered ones can undergo elimination instead of substitution. We had a little bit more discussion in this section than the others, so we're running a bit short on time. Let me introduce the third aspect of this reaction that I guess we'll now need to finish it off on Thursday. So the third thing that I want to talk about is leaving group. And let me just write up two different examples of reactions. Let's say we have some unspecified strong nucleophile that tries to come in and do the following attacks. Trying to push off a hydroxide versus pushing off a bromide. Which of these two reactions do you think is going to happen? The first one, the second one, both, or neither? Yes.
I vote for the second.
Does anybody else vote? Yes.
Second.
I second the second. Why? Because bromine's a good leaving group. When you kick it off, all you make is bromide minus, which we're not going to be necessarily an aqueous solution, but Br minus is something that easily could tolerate being an anion. If you kick off hydroxide, hydroxide's awfully basic. It doesn't really want to disconnect from the molecule in the first place, and in fact, it won't do so. So, in general, good leaving groups, and this will be the last thing that we wrap up with, good leaving groups are conjugate bases of strong acids.